Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and we are here for another episode of The Three Horsemen, and tonight we're going to be discussing the science fiction works of comic book writer Warren Ellis. He's done a lot of superhero stuff, but tonight we want to talk primarily about his science fiction work, of which there is a lot. I am joined, as always, by my two cohorts. Say hello, Mr. John Stevens.
Hello, Mr. John Stevens.
Ooh, how are you? Very sexy. I like it. I like it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Fred!
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, John. Go ahead.
I was going to do my spiel.
Do your spiel.
I'm a writer, and I'm a bookseller, and I write a lot for SF Signal. I write a regular-ish column that will soon be regular again, and reviews. I have a blog that, you know, occasionally I visit, and I'm working on two books.
Excellent. You know, since I've changed my diet up, I too hope to be regular again soon. So, what happened?
Oh, great. This will be one of these shows. Okay.
you recently tweeted that you got some very old Mark Twain editions recently. What happened with those?
Yeah, we went to, I work at pretty large used bookstore, and we do sell some new books, but mostly used books. And one of the ways that we get our books is through library book sales. And we went to a library book sale in a small town nearby, and just sitting on the shelf in the stacks amongst a bunch of other older books were some Twains, and we pulled them and brought them back, and they turned out to be first editions.
Wow.
Yeah. One of them, like the one that I actually put pictures up of on Twitter, is in really beat shape. But we did verify that it's a first printing, first edition. It's even got the, you know, the whole spiel about the by subscription and stuff. You know, remember Kickstarter in the 19th century was subscription.
what year were these editions?
It was Sketches Old and New, which was 1875. Is Shakespeare Dead, which I forget the exact data, but which is taken from his memoirs. So that's a later book. And then I'm going to mess it up because it's not in front of me. I want to say Rounding the Equator.
I think you're
right. That's not correct. No, it's not
traveling?
Correct.
Yeah, I know which one you mean.
The Equator, Following the Equator.
There we go.
And I forget the year of publication on that, but this was a first, but it was rebound, and actually it was completely rebound. They basically removed the pages from the old binding and put a new binding and covers on it. So it's still a first in terms of the material inside, but in terms of collecting as a collector's item, it's not worth a huge amount. But it is still a first edition because of the contents. And
says 1897.
Yep, that sounds right.
That
was also a later book.
That's great. Well, as long as they rebound it with the pages in order, it should be good. So.
Yeah, it's we thought it was a library rebinding, but they actually took the trouble to reconstitute the spine itself.
Wow.
So actually, the original spine cover is glued onto the outside of the spine. And they also put the frontispiece from the old cover on the front of the cover. So it was possibly a collector who just wanted to preserve what he could of the old cover, but keep it safe. So,
nice. Somebody treated that with
Yeah. They did, but not Sketches Old and New. Sketches Old and New was pretty beat up.
That was the doorstop, right?
That was the doorstop, exactly. but I'm actually thinking of adding that to my collection because the owner of the bookstore that I manage has made me an offer. I probably can't refuse on that.
Wow, excellent! Yeah. That's a very unique opportunity there. That's neat.
And it doesn't happen very often. I mean, a lot of people go to these bookstores hoping to strike it rich or find something really valuable, but that doesn't happen so much anymore.
Yeah. We've found a few. We frequent quite a lot, especially down here. We go to the Falls Church one all the time, and we found some really good stuff there.
We're lucky here in Ithaca that we have one of the largest book sales in the country. The Tompkins County runs a library sale.
Mm.
I mean, they have their own dedicated warehouse.
Wow.
And at last count, it was something ridiculous, like they had 118,000 volumes or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah. You are fortunate that I do not live there. I am fortunate that I do not live there. It would be like crack.
Get up pretty early in the morning for that one. Literally. I'm usually there at 3 in the morning in line.
Oh.
And there's a line already by the time I get there.
That's not me. I don't do that.
People camp out.
We have with us, as usual, Fred. Say hi, Fred.
Hi, Fred.
How is Fred tonight?
And I do have a warehouse full of books. And I could open a bookstore.
But there will not someday be a Franklin Park, New Jersey book sale anytime soon, I take it.
I am, as usual, still looking for some worthy cause to donate a good chunk of books to, but no one seems to want to take them off my hands.
Mm.
And John is too far away for a quick jaunt.
I think we're
The spirit is willing to, you know, up here, but the transportation mode is weak.
Right. Anyway, I'm Fred Kish. I blog at Bernal, Bernal Alpha. I'm on Tumblr and I'm on Twitter. And that's about all the social media I can handle, other than the fact that I do have a G+ page that kind of sits there and looks lonely.
Yes. Yeah, that does tend to happen. And I'm Jeff Patterson. I am at JeffPatterson11 on Twitter, and I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. And I have been on a few too many SF Signal podcasts recently, if you ask me. But people, for some reason, especially Patrick, want to keep hearing my voice, because I guess I make him look good or something. I don't know. So we got a few things we want to talk about tonight, but our main topic is going to be the science fiction of Warren Ellis. He's known for a lot of horror and various genre things. He started off with Lazarus Churchyard. He's done quite a bit of superhero stuff. He actually created the Extremis plot point for Iron Man that was used in Iron Man 3. He wrote the original comic for Red, which is now a movie franchise, was based on. Has done a lot of detective stuff, quite a bit of superhero stuff, but he's also done a lot of standalone science fiction work, which is not related to any existing comic book universe. Some of it was done for Wildstorm, some of it has been done for other studios as well. And I, for one, have always been a big fan of the standalone stuff. Almost all of it is collected in trade paperbacks. And quite recently, apparently I twisted Fred's arm to get him to read some of this. I don't recall it that way, but that's the way I keep hearing it told to me.
No, it's just comics in general.
So a few of the books that we wanted to talk about tonight were some of the ones that Fred had read, which also happened to be some of my favorites. I think the first one that I foisted on him was a book called Ignition City. Ignition City is a sort of a kind of a tribute and kind of a deconstruction of space pulp heroes of the Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, Perry Rodan stripe, about a girl who finds out that her father, who was one of these heroes, has recently died, and in trying to get some of his affairs in order, visits this place called Ignition City, which is a city that exists on an island, which is primarily where all these pulp heroes are sent when they retire. And when she gets there, she uncovers a mystery about what happened to her father. And we meet various tributes to Dr. Zarkov, and I think Captain Midnight, I think, is also in there at one point, and a few others. And I personally always liked the book. I always thought it was interesting that this was primarily a tribute to outer space pulp heroes that does not take place at all in outer space. And that, in fact, that tends to be one of the plot points of it, is that these guys are all effectively grounded in the aftermath of their adventures. And I thought the art was just plain gorgeous. It was one of those books that was released with multiple covers every time it came out. And I think it was the introduction to that, or it might have been another book where Warren talked about the fact that he really may have possibly have been a little unsure of himself when he went into the straight ahead science fiction stuff. The one interesting thing about this book is that it runs very similar in his approach to the book Planetary that he did, in the fact that he is not taking an existing property, but he is building a story out of these little tributes and pastiches of existing known properties, which is something he did a lot of in Planetary. And this is the only real example of a straight science fiction stuff that I can think of that this stuff happened, with the possible exception of Tokyo Storm Warning, but I'll talk about that in a bit. But I was curious, Fred, we tweeted about this a little bit, but I was curious on what your take of Ignition City was.
It was probably tied for my second favorite of the four that I read. And I love the touches or the nods to the past, like the Rocket Man suit, or the there's a space marshal running around with a Rocket Man suit. But the one problem I have is a problem I have with a couple of the titles. It's just one volume. And I feel like you're getting to know the universe, and all of a sudden it all stops. And I wanted to know more about the Venusians and the highland, you know, or the dryland Martians and things like that. Get off the island, see what's going on.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can spoil things. All these titles have been out for a while, so, you know, be warned. We will probably reveal something you don't want to know if you haven't read it. But the book ends at a very pivotal point, but that's where it ends. So what happens next? Because, I mean, she basically becomes, if we can say it, the marshal of the island.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, then what? Do we get off the island? Does...
What is this, Lost?
No, I did feel that way sometimes.
Well, that's interesting, because one of the things that went through my mind was if he had actually tried to tell a story like this in space, on a space station or stuff like that, I think it would have been tougher to bring all the baggage of these characters.
Right.
Wherein on this little city made out of old rocket parts and old spaceship parts and stuff like that, I think you could just sort of throw that baggage around willy-nilly and not really worry about it. I'm not going to try to read the mind of the writer here, but that was sort of my take on it, the fact that they were all grounded and that they were, quite frankly, has-beens over the course of the story is what kind of led its charm to me. I do agree with you. It would have been nice to see more, but he's known for doing these little standalones and, you know, hit and run quite often.
Okay.
I'm kind of curious, though. You said tied for second. What was the other one that tied for second with you?
Ministry of Space, which could have been my favorite. I mean, I grew up on the Von Braun, Collier, Chesley Bonestell space program, you know, the big ships with big fuel tanks and massive fleets of hundreds of people going to the moon or Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all in there, but that's the problem. It's like 48 pages, 50 pages or whatever, cramming 50 years worth of stuff. And it felt to me that it was more a sketch, almost like a story bible for a mini series on TV, rather than, yeah, you know, you go over 50 years worth of storyline. There's just so much they could have done, but you kind of like blow past decades, in order to get it all into this one small book.
Yeah. Ministry of Space is for those who don't know, is a story about, at the end of World War II, the British get, all the rocket scientists out of Germany, as opposed to the Americans, and develop quite rapidly a very robust space program, which actually outstrips the actual American one, which occurred in real life. And as we go through the course of this history being retold, and the entire denouement of the story is the fact that there are some dark secrets that led to the space program being as great as it was, and those are all kind of revealed at the end. John, did you read that one?
Ministry of Space? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorites, even though I think it's got a few problems, and one of them is something that is what Fred alluded to, is that it's really compacted. But I mean, that's one of the ones of Ellis's that I like the best. It's interesting to me because it does a bunch of things with history that I find interesting, like the insertion of sort of this of one person who really changes the course of things with their own obsession, basically, to get what they want at all costs. So the main character is Dashwood. So I think at the end is Sir John Dashwood.
Right.
He goes through several ranks over the course of the book. And it's really his vision and his desire for this to happen that really makes it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what creates basically the alternate history that unfolds in the book is his willingness to do some relatively extreme things in order to accomplish the goal of getting Britain into space. And what's interesting is using that as a focus for changing history, how that radiates out and how Ellis basically posits that shift sort of creates a new way for people to think about the future, essentially.
Yeah.
Because what happens over the course of the book is that basically, the society being posited is one that who's thinking about what the future could be changes. And I mean, one of the things Ellis really loves to do is mess with the future.
Yeah.
In his superhero books and in a lot of his books, messing with the future is a big thing for him. He loves to play with that. In Mystery Space, he really takes that into a broad palette. And what's one of the things I really like about it is that there's a certain amount of boldness in trying to sit down and say, okay, if this one change happened, what would the effects be all around? And some of them are very intriguing in terms of technological advance and stuff, and some of them are kind of disheartening in terms of what Dashwood has to do to accomplish his goal and some of the other effects that Ellis posits in the society. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorites for sure.
I also want to make mention here, the art in that book is by Chris Weston, and it is spectacular. And one of my favorite aspects of the way the art was done was it little touches like the shots where the point of view is looking down from the top of the rocket and you see like the cars in the parking lot, you know, things like that, as opposed to the very insular way that Americans do space launches. It just had a very charming feel for me. And the hardware is all gorgeous in it as well. So,
oh yes.
Yeah, it is. When you mentioned the Collier stuff, it was, you know, obviously influenced by that, but it really took it up several more steps. Where you actually see the ubiquity of space hardware in culture.
Right.
I liked it. Okay, then my next question for Fred is, what was your favorite?
Probably Ocean, because it was a self-contained story, but it seemed to really work as a self-contained story. It seemed longer, or maybe not really so much longer, but a more complete story than, say, Ministry of Space, because it concentrated on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the main character. Thought he was fun, and the crew of the space station around Europa. To give a summary, the main character is a weapons inspector who was sent to Europa because they've discovered something under the ice, and there's another station in orbit there that's also trying to take advantage of what is found. So you've got a quirky crew of men and women in the station that have been stuck there for like 3 years now and are tending to poison each other with bad cooking and things like that, and a lack of sex, and a very, very creepy corporate space station, more super science than you can throw a stick at, most of which, you know, I accepted. There was just one thing that threw me out of the story, and it was when I was like, oh, he mentions Moonbase Alpha, which is good. But then he mentions that the guy, the main character, says he had to be rescued because he fired his gun on the moon and got blown into orbit. Like, that was one hell of a gun, sir. Like, all except wormholes and billion-year-old hypersleep humans and super weapons run with a Windows operating system, but that just was like, no.
Oh, your nerd is showing. So.
Yes, yes. Well, what's the principle of writing? You get the little things right, and that way you can gloss over the big things?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what it was. But I liked the art. It was great, great, great art, great little story, very tight. It would make a great movie or a great TV series or something, you know, limited run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so of the four, that's the one that I thought was the best.
Yeah, that was Chris Sprouse did the art on that, who did Tom Strong with Alan Moore, and mm-hmm. he's got such a stylized line work, and his toolbox is quite nice when it comes to camera shots and perspective and compositions and stuff like that, and it tends to be a little more it's deceptively simplistic because he does get so much into a frame,
right?
And Ellis really took advantage of that. John, did you read that one?
Ocean's one of the few that I've not read.
Okay.
I went looking for my copy here, and it appears that it's in a box upstairs somewhere.
If people aren't familiar with kind of the, I don't want to, sort of the curmudgeonly flavor of a lot of Warren Ellis's stories, for lack of a better word. I want to jump off the straight ahead science fiction stuff and point to a miniseries he did for Marvel called Ruins, which basically took the entire Marvel universe from the early 60s, all the various origins and all the various, you know, incomprehensible events that led to the various characters, and sort of turned it on its head into the real world, where all the things that occurred that turned these people into superheroes in the Marvel universe actually had the kind of effects that they would have on people in the real world, where they get mutated and die of horrible cancers and things go awful, awful, and horribly wrong. It was a very, very dark comedy that I highly recommend, but that sort of really, you know, put his foot down as to the kind of sensibility that he was bringing to a lot of books. But he's also, you know, capable of a great deal of humor. There was quite a bit of humor in Ocean, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
he also, for humorous books, Fred and I were talking about this before the podcast, he did a standalone book called Switchblade Honey, which was basically a homage to Star Trek and other flying around and bump into thing shows, where the crew is a bit more unsavory and working class than the cast you would find on most of these shows. And it was quite humorous, but it was also a very good science fiction story involving this large mechanism that would actually laze a sun and stuff like that. It was pretty exciting. That was also that was a black and white book as well, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. with some gray tone. John,
For over-the-top humor, you have to go with Next Wave for Ellis.
Yes, yes. Next Wave was a...
so over-the-top.
Next Wave, Agents of Hate was he used... I don't even want to call them C-listers from the Marvel Universe, but he took a lot of very obscure characters.
Like K-listers.
Huh?
Like K-listers.
Yeah, and a lot of...
pretty far down the alphabet.
A lot of offspring from some marginal characters from their past, and sent them off on this very surrealist jaunt through various little storylines. I remember this one giant multiple page spread where they're fighting all of these various assorted oddball surrealist villains, and his script actually called for an Elvis MODOK. And that is exactly what was drawn. It's MODOK with an Elvis head. I think it even had sunglasses on it. It's firing a little mind beam out, and yeah, that was pretty funny stuff. A couple of the books that are genre books, but not necessarily science fiction books. He had two books that came out right around the same time. Fell, which was a story of a detective in a city that quite literally had no hope left. And another book called Desolation Jones, which was about an ex-British spy who had been subjected to this thing called the Desolation Test, where he was basically suspended in a form of living death and for the most part tortured for an entire year so that when he came out of it, he really wouldn't have any fear, but he also wasn't capable of feeling anything. He was quite literally emotionally distant from just about everything around him. And he is placed in retirement in Los Angeles, and it turns out the Los Angeles area is now basically a game preserve for all these old spies that are kicking around. And that the first arc of that, which he did, which I highly recommend, J.H. Williams was the artist on it, I think, involved somebody who possessed and has had stolen from him Hitler's personal homemade pornography collection, and the various sundry characters around L.A. who now want to get access to this. Really good story. John, amongst the Ellis that you have read science fiction wise, what really stands out for you?
Well, besides Ministry of Space, Orbiter definitely stands out for me in a number of ways.
Do tell.
Orbiter is well, I mean, to my mind, it's in some ways it's a very straightforward book, but in other ways it's a very kind of odd book for Ellis. I mean, one of Ellis's calling cards is often the creation of sort of extreme environments. And there's often, quite often, frankly, a lot of violence, too. There's a huge amount of violence. But Orbiter, while it does have some violence in it, isn't really about that. Orbiter, to me, is like probably the most hopeful thing Ellis has ever written in terms of the story and the point that he's trying to make with the story. So Orbiter basically tells a story set in the near future of an old space shuttle that returns to Earth mysteriously after being gone for 10 years. And no one can figure out what happened to it, why it came back when it did. And it crash lands at Kennedy Space Center, which apparently is some kind of slum now or refugee camp or something. It's never completely explained. But a group of people who formerly worked in different aspects of the space industry are brought back to figure out how the shuttle came back and to talk to the lone crew member who's still on board and who flew it back. But what the story ends up really being about is this idea that humans, and Ellis has done this in a lot of some other books too, but you know, builds on this idea of us needing to go into space, of us needing to explore, and that theme is really what powers this book, is the people come together to solve this mystery and end up sort of realizing that what they really need to do is the next step after solving the mystery is to actually go out into space and take those first new steps. So in some ways I like the book quite a lot because he puts it together quite well, and the art is by Colin. We were just talking about this before we started the podcast, was Colleen Doran. So the art is quite good. It's a little murky sometimes for me, but it's very evocative, and it definitely suits the storytelling purposes and meshes quite well with them. So that one for me is a pretty good book. I like the way that he puts the message together. And creates an interesting story around it, because it's not just about the shuttle itself or the crew member who returns, but it's about these other people who are trying to solve the mystery and what they essentially sort of find out about themselves over the course of reconstructing what happened to the shuttle.
Yeah, when Orbiter came out in 2003, it came out as a hardcover. It did not come out as individual comics like a lot of these other books we're talking about did. It was a standalone hardcover with a spectacular painted cover. I got my copy, and that September, WorldCon was in Boston, and Colleen Doran was going to be there. That was the WorldCon that Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett were the guests of honor. And the odd part was that Warren Ellis was actually at DragonCon that year, the same weekend. And Colleen Doran was in the dealer's room, and she was selling quite a bit of original art, and I bought a print of that cover of Orbiter, but I had my copy of Orbiter with her for her to sign, and she pulls out her silver pen and draws on the black end paper a gorgeous sketch of a shuttle launching, which I just sat there and drooled like a fanboy as she drew for me. So I was very happy. I actually lost that copy for a few years in my moves, and when I moved down here to Virginia, I refound it when I was unpacking stuff. So I've reread it several times since then. And someday Fred's copy will show up, because I know he ordered it.
Twice.
And it has yet to arrive.
Stuck in Texas.
But yeah, that's definitely worth reading. It's one of his better science fiction forays, I think.
I think the reason this subject interested me so much is because one of the complaints that I have had about comics in general over the last 10 years is the fact that they've done really good jobs embracing a lot of fantasy tropes, a lot of urban fantasy tropes, a lot of horror tropes. And in the cases of those genres, they have managed to, for the most part, keep up with what's going on in science fiction literature in general, what's being published book-wise and story series-wise, etc. Wherein the science fiction elements that have come into play in quote-unquote mainstream comics have always tended to be a bit old school. Recently we've seen Marvel talking about the singularity, and in the various DC reboots there's been a lot of super science and cutting-edge stuff. But they still tended to be conflicting empires, and everything had to be very, old school space opera type tropes. You going to say something there, John?
No, I was agreeing. I think that's quite true.
And when Ellis brought when Ellis did these standalone stories, and there was a period where he had a new miniseries out like every few months. It was very refreshing to see these standalone stories that really tackled things like, the study of the enigma, such as an ocean or Orbiter for that matter, or his take on a slightly deconstructed space opera like in Switchblade Honey and stuff like that. And for me, it was just enjoyable to see standalone straight science fiction stories, regardless of what your definition of hard SF is. Because it showed, without a doubt, in my opinion, that science fiction and sense of wonder work so well in the comic format. I've had a lot of creators tell me they don't think that straight science fiction works in comics. And that's just ridiculous in my eyes. And I think a lot of the Ellis stories, proved otherwise.
Why don't they think this?
Because they think that the language and the storytelling vernacular of comics, especially in the established universes, sort of renders it impossible.
They think that genre and medium are too closely aligned.
Yes.
There are only certain things you can do with a comic book,
which I have never bought. I mean, I used
to, which I haven't either. I totally agree.
One of the arguments that I always made when that argument came up was, look at those Thor stories from the late 70s and the early 80s, where he was primarily flying around space meeting aliens. Okay. You take that stack of stories and actually map out what their plots were, and you could put that on par with any of the more wildly imaginative series of seasons of Doctor Who that you can imagine. It was him arriving somewhere. There's a bunch of aliens. There's a mystery or a conflict that needs to be resolved. Mm-hmm. Thor goes around trying to understand what things are, and then he spins his hammer and solves it. but they were in the way that they were plotted and the way that they were strung together, they were done in that way. Look at the sheer number of diehard hard science fiction stories that have occurred in Fantastic Four. You know, that was kind of its calling card. But even then, the ones that were the superhero science fiction stories, as opposed to the ones that were actual science fiction stories, there is a dividing line. A lot of the stuff that Walt Simonson did was clearly straight SF, and the same with John Byrne. So, you know, I've never believed it. And I'll add on to that, a lot of the stuff that Marvel has done recently with the Avengers and the Infinity miniseries and stuff like that, yes, a lot of it was space opera, but it felt a lot more like modern space opera as opposed to, you know, taking the tropes from, you know, tales of old and applying them. It brought with it a sensibility. It brought with it a tangibility. The threat was a tangible thing. It was no longer just this, ooh, there's a big ship coming, how do we stop it? There was an actual existential threat that was going on that had to be resolved. And it was nice to see that. I wrote a column for SF Signal about it. It was very, very nice to see that. But once again, you can do that. But in doing that, you sort of have to start, you know, ignoring a lot of the baggage that these comic book universes bring with them, which can be difficult.
Why I like these, though, overall, more than I've liked Marvel or DC, you know, established series, because
precisely
they don't have the baggage.
Precisely.
And that's, I think that's also why I liked Anna Mercury the least.
Okay.
Because it seemed to be too much more like a superhero comic, you know, with that, the wild hair and, you know, all jumping around and flying through
Anna
the
Mercury's
air.
Anna Mercury is very cinematic.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very much like cinematic sort of SF, sort of fantasy, like science fantasy, essentially.
Okay.
Right? It's more of, you know, sort of Judge Dredd science fiction than,
yeah,
Doc Smith science fiction or something.
That's a very adept way of putting it, John.
And my understanding from what little I've heard Ellis write about Andy Mercury is that that was kind of his intention, was to do something much more visually spectacular that kind of took some inspiration from superheroes and from things like, you know, 2000 AD, which sort of played a lot with the borders between, say, pulpy science fiction and superhero comics, and created an assortment of, you know, sort of hybrids who were sort of superheroic science fiction characters like Dredd, Nemesis the Warlock, things like that.
Right.
And of course, that's what Ellis is coming out of, is writing that kind of stuff.
Right.
And he kind of goes back to that a bit with Anna Mercury. And I think, you know, if you're trying to put these on sort of a spectrum of genre relation, that's pretty far down the science fiction, pretty close to the superhero zone.
Right.
Because she is clearly much more of a superhero than a science hero, shall we say.
Yeah. Did either of you two, I'm going to guess Fred didn't. He did a standalone book called Frankenstein's Womb.
No.
And I haven't read it. I've seen it, but I have not.
Yeah, I forget. It's basically Mary Shelley, as she's traveling through England, sort of stops and has this vision of the monster telling her everything that her writing Frankenstein will do to the future. Okay. It's a very, very trippy book, and I highly recommend it. highly recommend it. A couple others I wanted to mention real quick. On that mention of the far end of the science fiction spectrum, he did a miniseries called Black Summer, which involved...
I was going to mention that, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I was going to mention that, too, if you didn't.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Black Summer is a superhero comic that has, I guess, what you would call technological superheroes, right? Science heroes. But no kind of science heroes that could ever probably really exist. But Black Summer is, I guess you could say, it's a little inspired by something along the lines of Miracle Man. A sort of, or, you know, a lot of Ellis's own straight superhero work, like The Authority and Stormwatch, where, you know, what if the superheroes really took, you know, some of their ideas to the ultimate level? And in this case, is what if superheroes decides, you know, I really don't like the way the United States is being run, so I'm going to destroy the government and, you know, basically level everything. And the rest of his friends and his highly dysfunctional super team have to attempt to stop him. And basically, without putting in spoilers, you know, extreme hilarity ensues.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's one of the things Ellis, I think, does well is take assumptions about various scenarios and figures out ways to push them into more provocative terrain, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard for me not to think about him in relation to Alan Moore because I'm writing this apparently very long piece about Alan Moore right now, and after having read his quote unquote biography. Moore likes to construct these intricate enigma puzzles as a basis for his story. And what Ellis tries to do is he actually tries to do something very different where it's not the mystery that's interesting, it's where you're going to get it's where you arrive. It's yeah. interesting. So with Black Summer, you know, the destruction of the government, the assassination of politicians, and then the interaction between the heroes is really about leading to a certain point that's supposed to make you stop and think. And Orbiter's like that too. They unravel the mystery, but the mystery is not quite as interesting as where you get to in the end. And Black Summer is very much like that because you can compare it to things like Miracle Man and other stories that attempt to take that idea of, you know, what superheroes could really do if they were so powerful to the extreme, and tries to make you think past that to other issues.
He visited that, pardon me, in a book a couple of years ago called Super God, which sort of took a similar approach, but told it in the form of the kind of history that Fred mentioned with Ministry of Space, which is where all the various governments had programs to create superhumans, and the vast unrest and wholesale destruction that occurs as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And it once again, there's a lot of flaming London, like you saw in Miracle Man and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of cities on fire and orbital shots of continents with dead zones in the middle and stuff like that. You know, the eyeball kicks that really make you realize how high the stakes are.
But, you know, Black Summer's about destruction, but not quite on that scale, right?
Yeah,
because with Black Summer, there's a lot of violence and destruction.
Yeah, there is, but it's also about people just wanting to get back to their lives too, you know?
Right,
which is kind
right
of,
and right, not only regular people, but some of the heroes themselves.
Yes,
and I really like the subtext of, you know, the conundrum of having technology and whether you should use it or not.
Yeah. Which
kind of sneaks up on you as a theme, but then becomes, I think, pretty obvious as you go through the miniseries.
Right. Yeah.
I read it as a miniseries when it first came out, and it was interesting to stop around issue 4 and go, oh, that's an interesting little aspect of this. Yes. And that's one of the things that Ellis really does well is he can slip stuff like that in and get you to think about things like that.
Yeah, he took a lot of cutting edge science theory that was bouncing around at the time and weaponized it just about in every single way. And
yep.
That was how a lot of these characters' abilities
right.
Came to be.
Right. That's great. I mean, that's one of the things that Ellis actually does is he, more so than a lot of his peers, he at least tries to take science theory seriously. Mm-hmm. He's not a scientist.
Right.
And a lot of his stuff isn't technologically plausible. Like, he doesn't lay out the actual, you know, complete mechanics and things like that. But he's very interested in theories. He's very interested in the possibilities for technology, and he definitely pulls that out and uses it in a lot of his work.
He does a lot of that in Planetary as well. a lot of this, right. A lot of the secret history of the Wildstorm universe that he that he explores in there. He pulls out all kinds right. of all kinds of cutting edge mm-hmm. stuff, which was being bounced yep. around on the science blogs.
And in Orbiter 2, the heart of the mystery is these sort of incredible theories about you know, a kind of incredible theory to explain how you could possibly have a space shuttle, say, fly to Mars and back, and actually land on Mars and then come back.
Right.
And it's sort of technological philosophy at a certain level, but also it's you know, this constant thing that Ellis likes to do of pushing people's ideas. And he likes to do it in a much more philosophically argumentative way than, like, again, to go back to Alan Moore, who likes to put puzzles together and have people try to take them apart. You know, if Ellis really wants you to have a conversation with his theories, because a lot of his characters do you know, tend to perform as you know Bob's.
Yeah.
But it's in the service of getting the reader to think about the possibilities of science in the future.
Yeah, no, it's dead.
And he, you know, he is someone who actually calls himself a science fiction writer, too. He said in a number of interviews, you know, I'm a science fiction writer. And he takes that attitude and brings it to, you know, a medium that says, that a lot of people say can't handle that, and he actually makes it work. He's definitely produced stories that I think science fiction readers would really find interesting.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. Hence the podcast. A couple other ones I wanted to mention real quick, which we got to bring up here, that I've always been high on my radar. He did a 3-issue series called Tokyo Storm Warning, which I believe can still be found combined in a trade paperback with the original miniseries Red, which the movie was based on. Tokyo Storm Warning was predates Pacific Rim and plays in the same playground. It's basically giant mecha versus kaiju. The play here, though, I recently watched Pacific Rim, and one of the things that I found kind of missing was that a lot of the over-the-top kaiju stories tend to always sort of beat you over the head with a metaphor. Pacific Rim does not. And Tokyo Storm Warning sort of starts off with the whole metaphor, wherein the Americans learn that Japan is building atomic weapons, that they decide to bomb Hiroshima. And shortly after the war, giant monsters and giant mecha start appearing. And the why this happens is revealed at the end of the story, and it sort of makes the entire story a metaphor, a living one that actually tends to be affecting modern society. It was 3 issues, had a lot of robot on monster action, but also had a lot of really fun characters. Two other ones I want to mention. One was kind of long form. He had a 12-issue series called Global Frequency, which was done for Wildstorm yep. as well, which was about a organization called Global Frequency, which has members much like a hyper-organized version of the Shadows network.
I was about to say, it's really like the Shadow meets the X-Files.
Yes. And so what happens is every issue, something is discovered, normally something left over. Either a weapon that was left over, or something that was forgotten, or a entity which was never properly retired. And the people in charge of Global Frequency contact whoever is nearest there, and they get whoever the experts they need on their special super cell phones, which we can now laugh at here in the future. And there tends to be a lot of groupthink in this book. It was 12 issues. It was done very well. My favorite is probably the cyborg issue, where he talks about if you build a cyborg, you don't just give him a fake arm, because the first time you use it, his spine pops out of his body. So you'd have to modify his entire physiology to make it work.
We'll see if they remember that for Deathlock and S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was done really well. And one last
book. It was very well done. It was very well done. Yeah, did you ever see the unshown pilot?
Yes, there was
a TV pilot.
TV pilot that was made. If one wanted to delve into video piracy, you could certainly find copies online. I would never suggest that, but I have seen it, and it is very good. It's too bad it was
very good. Michelle Forbes did a great job.
Yes,
I thought.
Yes,
in the lead role as Miranda Zero. That was.
It was also awesome. An interesting book that every issue had a different artist. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of fun because it changed things up quite a bit. And the one last one I wanted to mention, he did a series of four books called the Apparat Books, which were designed to be the fictional first issues of series that never actually occurred. It was an odd little conceit. And there was one in there called Angel Stomp Future. And you talked about Ellis's penchant for making people think about the future. This particular story, which is narrated, by this girl who is breaking the fourth wall, she's talking to the reader the entire time, is living in a world where there is a disease, a syndrome, which is going around, which makes people stop thinking about the future, basically. People start turning their back on advancement and stuff like that. And as the story goes on, we learn more about it. And that's a book that has a very good surprise ending that I don't want to spoil for anybody. But it was a single issue. I think all four of the Apparat books are collected in the trade paperback. And we will put the links up for all that. John, are there any other books you wanted to mention?
We might want to mention Transmetropolitan.
Ooh, yeah.
I'm just gonna put that out there for you. There's this one other little science fiction series that Warren Ellis wrote for a little while.
Yeah, we were joking about that. And you know what? That's one of those books that I would actually argue with you because I don't think it counts as science fiction anymore.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because it almost I would call it science fiction because I tend to be broad in my application of genre designations.
Yes. No,
but it's not science fiction so much as the use of science fictional tropes for the purposes of political satire primarily.
Yes. The furniture is there. So
he's not as interested in the kind of speculative thought that has been in a lot of the stuff we've already talked about of his. Mm-hmm. He's much more interested in political satire and in sort of messing kind of in that he's much more messing with the future and playing with the idea of dystopia and what works and what doesn't work now in the present. And at the same time, he's taking a lot of shots at political targets that he wants to take down and that he wants to show for their foolishness. And he chooses a science fictional template, essentially, to structure that and uses and populates with all these tropes. But it's like I said, it's much more, I mean, in a way it's this extremely decadent romp through a future that probably couldn't happen, but that is designed to serve as sort of a cautionary tale for considering the life that we live in the present and some of the possible directions that our politics could go in the future. Mm-hmm. And not directly, like I don't think he directly thinks the future that he presents there is the one we're heading towards, but he wants to make this outrageous future for people to stop and scratch their heads and go, couldn't happen, or is that something that's kind of happening now that we should think about in a different form? And I think Transmit goes off the rails three or four times at least, but in a sense that's his most playful, I think his most playful series that I've read of his work.
You know, something that went through my mind, I did a reread of that, the whole series, I want to say 2 years ago, and one of the things that I enjoyed about it, which also struck me as being kind of unique, was that the protagonist, Spider Jerusalem, is a journalist and is using not so much social media, but he's basically using live feeds. But he's writing them. He's sort of Edison Carter from Max Headroom, only instead of a video camera, he's running around writing about things as they're happening. And the technology that he uses and the technology which is at play over the course of the story, I don't want to say that the technology itself becomes a character, but the story can't travel in the directions that it goes in without that technology being there.
Right.
His use of media and his use of content distribution and the input of his editor and the input of his assistants and stuff like that really plays a big part on that story. He could have told the tales that he told there in another genre, but he would have had to have gone the long way around to do it.
Sure.
And I think I want to say that was 75 issues, I think, altogether. It's under 100, but I want to say it was
under 100.
I want to say it was
between, it was at least 60.
Yeah.
What was it, more than 60? It might have only been 60.
And I think it would, yeah. You might be right, because I think it's 10 trades altogether, so it might be 60. You could be right.
That sounds right. Yes. I'm actually looking at a Warren Ellis bibliography, and it does go to 60.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very hilarious art by Derek Robertson.
Something else that should be mentioned, that book was one of the first titles in DC's short-lived Helix line. Helix was supposed to be the science fiction response to Vertigo, and produced a number of very good books that came out at that time by a lot of really top-notch artists and writers. And it died probably because science fiction doesn't work in comics. Transmet survived that and ended up becoming a Vertigo book. I want to say after the first year and a half, but it might be later than that. Now my nerd is showing.
No, I don't think it was much later than that, because I want to say by at least like issue 13 or 14, okay, it switched over.
Yeah.
But I don't remember exactly.
But yes, all of that is really good stuff. Plus, there is a great number of his superhero work, both in both the big universes plus the Wildstorm universe. We mentioned his Stormwatch stuff, which led to his work in The Authority, which is probably still one of my favorite superhero series, those first 12 issues that he wrote.
And that is very science fictional.
Very, very science fictional. It's basically those first three stories are a Fu Manchu story, a Ming the Merciless story, and a Cthulhu story. So, and I believe he said so himself when he was doing the interviews for those pieces. And Next Wave Agent of Hate, I don't even want to get into, because that was just such an insane series, which you need to have no previous knowledge of comics whatsoever to enjoy it. Because even the people that had previous knowledge of the Marvel Universe were taken completely aback by it.
Right. And that's one of the things I loved about Next Wave, was that I went into it not knowing what to expect other than it was a Warren Ellis title and was just completely sort of upended.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it falters in places with the humor, but he really did find something totally, you know, left field to do with the characters.
Yes.
And to play with them, but also you know, getting in some ideas about, you know, who is and who is not, you know, useful, and who is and who is not you know, in a sense worthy of the mantle of superhero, essentially.
Yeah.
But through, you know, pretty crazy humor and a lot of surreal. I mean, it's hard to keep saying it's surreal, but it is, and it's intended to be.
In the actual definition of surrealism, yes.
Yeah, and yet it's played completely straight by the characters for the most part.
Yes.
Because they're stuck in it, and they have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
They have to deal with the reality, the unreality they are presented with.
Right.
And, you know, and the subtext of the book is that they're sort of fighting for reality, essentially.
Yeah, and it was odd because when reading that book, I kept thinking back to books like Vertigo books like Shade the Changing Man and stuff like that, which really tried to push the envelope when it came to, and Doom Patrol by Grant Morrison, which really tried to
That's a very good comparison. Yeah, the Morrison Doom Patrol stuff.
Those Vertigo books really tried to they created their own niche in playing with reality and truly oddball villains and you know villains that made you know TV Batman villains look like freaking babies in diapers and stuff like that, just truly horrific, nightmarish, surrealist villains, and especially in using Shade the Changing Man is that the madness, which was sort of the uncontrollable force which ran through that book, tended to just throw all these different warps into reality and transpositions and stuff like that. And it was done in a very, you know, dramatic sense, as most of the Vertigo books were done. Next Wave used all the toys in that toy box to a completely different effect.
Right.
It said, okay, we can do this now. Let's go play with it. And highly recommended. Like I said, there's a few characters you might recognize in the Marvel Universe, but not many.
Exactly.
One of the things we had tweeted about that Fred wanted to mention real quick is how are you reading your comics these days when you read them?
I'll start with this because I think I might be kind of the mixer. I don't know. I have a large library of graphic novels. I actually did get rid of my comics collection a number of years ago. But I have a pretty hefty library of graphic novels. So I have been, as with books, kind of a paper aficionado for the most part. But recently, and I think I said it before we started the podcast, only in the last couple of weeks have I started to look at stuff online. And I just recently downloaded a program to read. What's the file extension, Jeff?
CBR? CBZ.
And actually, I've been very pleased with the way the art looks. The resolution's pretty good. I mean, I've got a decent monitor, but the program and the formatting seem to work really well. In fact, it looks like comics at the moment are in some ways getting much better service out of being digitized than print books are. Because I don't get like I read electronic books very unwillingly.
Mm. You know, I think the fact that so much of the art is done digitally now, I just think it tends to have a right. it pops a little more when you read them on readers.
Yeah,
I use so,
that's been my experience.
Yeah, for my tablet, I use the free version of CBR, and I use CDisplay on my desktop here, which are both good for being able to zoom in. And save specific images if you're looking for it. CBR is wonderful at organizing things too. Even the free version, if you load a bunch of comics from your subscriptions into it, it will sort them out by title and by folder, and will normally, parse enough of the information that's the metadata of the comic so that you can get stuff in numerical order. And if you're reading a number of titles together, when you get to the end of an issue and you press the next page button, it will say, do you want to go to the next issue? And you do, and it brings you right into it. I recently did my first reread of Mike Carey's Lucifer series digitally. I'd read the individual issues probably, God, 10 times the full run since I came out, but I just did my first reread of it fully digitally, and it was a much different experience. I've got a lot of trade paperbacks as well. And Fred, you ordered all trades on the books you read, correct?
Yeah, because I wasn't sure if I ordered any electronic, whether they'd be compatible across different platforms. You know, is CVR, I mean, if you buy a Comixology, can you read it using whatever you use to read CVR, for example, or are you stuck with Comixology?
They should be mostly transferable. I think that became... I'm not going to answer that. I'm going to do a little bit of research on it before I put this podcast up. So we'll look into that.
I mean, I've... got a lot of web comics, you know, like Schlock Mercenary, Sluggy Freelance. I've been reading things like that for years, so I've got files upon files upon files of, you know, images downloaded and saved. But yeah, okay. Most of my comic or graphic novel collecting has been the trade paperbacks, older stuff like Prince Valiant. I'm buying the Fantagraphics hardcovers. Again, it's kind of on the edge, but I've been buying things like Pogo and hardcover now. Sandman, I bought the omnibus editions, yeah, as well as the...
That's just gorgeous.
Was it,
yeah,
the annotated edition?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I've been buying those.
Yeah, my philosophy with a lot of trades has been there are certain series that are coming out now, like Saga and Prophet and stuff like that, that I always get the trades for just to have them because I know I'm going to reread them like crazy. But once in a while, you just get an edition that comes out that is just, as a physical object, just too pretty not to own. The last Humanoids omnibus of Meta Barons was the last big weak spot for me. It was just this giant hardcover phone book of just spectacular painted art that was printed so meticulously well, much, much better than the individual issues that had come out. And it's just one of those books that you just drop it on your lap and say, the hell with the leg bruises I'm going to have, and just dive into it for a long amount of time. And something else that just dawned on me, Fred, you mentioned web comics. Warren Ellis did do one web comic called Freak Angels, which was collected as trade paperbacks, but they were done, I think, in 6-page installments online for free when they first came out, which had to do with...
I followed that for about the first year, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can just see if I get more and more into this, I'm going to need to buy another warehouse. You know, so. I'd rather find a good electronic means, because that's what I'm trying to do now, instead of buying paperbacks or trade paperbacks. I'd rather buy an ebook.
Yeah, I really swore that I was never going to replace most of my comics, but the move down here to Virginia, I ended up selling and giving away so many long boxes of comics, and I kept the ones that really meant a lot to me, and just about everything I've acquired since then has been digitally, and I really can't see myself ever going back. Number one, the convenience of having them. Number two, even though I'm reading a 10-inch tablet, the zoom on it is really nice, and you're getting basically, you know, you're getting it almost all the way to its original size. And, you know, there are larger tablets that one could do if one wanted to buy something solely for comic book reading. And if I had the dithers and the money and the free time, I certainly would. But it's... And like you said, a lot of modern books with the digital art really tends to really pop when you read them on a screen, which is basically how they're created anyway, you know? I mean, even when I do my annual cards and I do the art mostly digitally and I look at them online and I go, oh, that's gorgeous. And then I look at them printed and I go, this is crap. So, you know, it depends on your motivation. And right. even books that are designed to be eyeball candy, like the Superman Unchained that came out recently, that was a comic that was almost purposely made to be read in a digital format. You know, it was no matter how much you zoomed in, it just was gorgeous. And plus, Marvel's doing things where they're adding adding Easter eggs, and they've got little logos that run through that when you click on it, you get added content to the book. You know, links to videos or links to histories and stuff like that. And they're really starting to play with the format a bit. Hmm. Excellent. I love it. Yes. Yeah, so the science fiction works of Warren Ellis. One franchise that I don't believe that Warren Ellis ever played in, though, in the Marvel Universe, was the S.H.I.E.L.D. organization. Fortunately, we have a TV show that is covering this, playing well in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And if you've heard our esteemed producer, Patrick Hester, rave about the show, you know that it tends to be a bit of a dividing factor. I've been running hot and cold on it, but the gentlemen, my co-hosts, have some theories about this.
And well, that would be me.
That would be you, Fred.
And it mostly occurred to me because I've been listening to the Nerdist podcast network, I guess it is now, has one called the Nerdist Writers Panel, which is mostly television writers. And they've had, in the episodes I've heard, people who have been in on Buffy, Angel, etc., and they talk about the writers' rooms and working with Joss Whedon and whatever. And, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. has been divisive, and I think there's a couple of reasons. First off, possibly because everyone who's they've talked to about their writers' room has said, oh, it's such a wonderful place to work. Well, was it always that wonderful? Well, no, the first couple of years, it took a while for us to find our way. So it's early in the show. Secondly, it doesn't seem that Whedon is It does not appear to me that Joss Whedon is as directly involved in this as he has been with Buffy or earlier shows. And my third theory as to why this show has been kind of uneven and whatnot is that can they really do anything major in the Marvel Universe that will change the course of a movie or a comic book? Or is it something Marvel and Disney and ABC did? Oh, we need a show. We need a show. Well, we can't do anything major, but we need a show, you know. I mean, I really want it. I like Coulson. I like some of the other characters. I can see the potential, but I'm wondering whether it's ever going to be allowed to grow on its own.
Well, I think the last point there about not wanting to do anything major is something I definitely see. I think it's the reason that, you know, J. August Richards is not Luke Cage. He's going to be Deathlok. You know? It's like, you know, who would have been a great Luke Cage? J. August Richards. Who's going to be? Deathlok. Because they're not committing anything, any major cultural capital from Marvel, you know?
Right.
And as soon as you said that, I thought that definitely nails one of the things that I find problematic, is that there's no sense that much is going to happen. They're going to run around and solve some poorly constructed mysteries using science magic, and that's what the show's going to be about, it seems. I mean, it doesn't seem about deep character development. It doesn't seem about pulling people deeper into the movie universe. It just, you know, the feeling of it as kind of a placeholder to some extent,
right,
is quite palpable. I agree with you on that.
You know, one of the things that I like about the show, and this is just because I'm jaded, when I look at other shows, I hate to make this comparison, but I'm going to compare it to Torchwood for a minute here, because they have kind of played in roughly the same area. But my big problem with Torchwood was that every character on Torchwood was irredeemably damaged. Mm-hmm. And these were the people that were our last line of defense against horrible, horrible things. And 9 times out of 10, they did a horrible job of dealing with it. And so many times I come into a show like this wherein there is supposed to be some implied significance to what the main characters, the team, is doing. And the more we get to learn about this team, the more we go, these people are not cut out to be doing this. They've played a little bit. They've skirted around the edges of that with S.H.I.E.L.D. And even though each character has issues and some characters are, yes, damaged, that damage and those issues is one of the reasons why they're with the team and why they've, you know, chosen this life. And that I kind of like. I wish that was kind of amped up a little more. And I agree, I'd like to see stories with a bit more ballast to them. And I'm really hoping that the scope of this whole mystery that they're diving into gets bigger and actually has some impact. Keep in mind, we're only halfway through, and we're not going to see any more issues, episodes during sweeps, I think. So we're going to have to wait till May sweeps.
Okay.
Which hopefully we'll get some impact there. But I'm not giving up on it, so.
Well, neither am I, but yeah. It's just not the first thing I watch.
Yeah.
No, I'm letting episodes accumulate. Yeah. So I'll get to the rest.
It's possible that my expectations were too high going in.
I think everybody's were. I really do.
But the idea that it will take them some time to get their footing seems to me not a very good excuse for not pulling us right in and, you know, taking these characters, most of whom are not to... Yeah, make too much of this, are disposable. They're characters they could do a lot with because they're not part of the, you know, the mighty Marvel canon, right?
Right.
These are precisely the characters you can that you can use to show the effects of this increasingly bizarre world on regular people.
Right.
Right. I mean, they're particular people who are skilled and who are supposedly trained to deal with some of the problems that they encounter, but they're regular people. And this is all, in large measure, very new to them. And I think they're really missing some opportunities for character development and for creating a show that combines sort of mystery and action of superhero comics with the sort of the tension of, you know, revelation of coming into a world that is strange and unpredictable, and documenting that the effects of that on these relatively normal people.
Yeah, I would point.
So that would be an awesome show.
Yeah, I would point to... Jim Steranko's commentary on individual episodes of the show. Jim Steranko was an instrumental artist on S.H.I.E.L.D. for years when it was a comic book, and brought a very bizarre 70s vibe to it, and really broke a lot of ground in comic book storytelling. And he's made some, aside from the show simply not being Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. the way it was portrayed in comics, he also makes some very interesting points storytelling-wise, which I've been rather impressed with.
Oh, excellent.
So, do you want to talk about culture consumed?
Sure.
Fred, what do you got?
Well, I've sent a link, which Jeff will post, of my current reads. Yes, believe it or not, folks, I am simultaneously reading all those books, just not with all my eyeballs.
You are Argus, the thousand-eyed one.
I wish I could be that. I'm most actively reading actually only one science fiction book and two mystery books. I'm reading Solaris by Stanislaw Lem for the first time in quite a few decades. This is a edition which currently is only available as an audiobook or an ebook. The edition that most people know was translated from the Polish into French and then into English and at some point abridged. This one is now finally translated directly from Polish to English and not abridged.
Ah.
So it's worth looking at if you've read it in the past.
Are you taking anything away from those differences? Are you noticing anything?
It's been so long since I read it earlier that it's like it's a new book at this point.
Are they going to do this with a number of Lem books? Or?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there are a number of new editions in e-format and others, but they seem to be exactly the same as previous editions.
Wow. Huh.
I mean, one thing I forget who had talked about this. It could have been Jeff Vandermeer or maybe Patrick... Nielsen Hayden at Tor about how expensive a translation is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like one of the biggest costs in a book. If you're going to take it from non-English to English, that's like, you know, a big commitment. So I'm not sure how well Lem, I mean, he was selling quite well way back when, in the dawn of time when we all had darker hair and stuff. But I'm not sure how popular he is today with American audiences and whether more of his stuff would become available. Same with the Strugatsky brothers. I'd love to see some stuff like The Snail on the Slope or Tale of the Troika come back out, but the only one that really seems to be in print at the moment is Stalker, Roadside Picnic, rather. And there was another one came out like a week or so ago. I forget the name, but you know, it's not too much of their stuff's out.
Do you happen to know if when the George Clooney Solaris movie came out, I'm assuming there was a release tie-in of the book there?
It was the same exact abridged double translation.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, it even says so on the inside. You know, it says something like, you know, this was translated from the French and the Polish and then abridged. So it's the same edition that I bought in 1975, whenever the movie came out to the U.S.
It's too bad that movie studios don't have the money to you know, splurge for a new translation for promotional purposes when this.
Well, they're too busy buying plates of cheese or whatever for the writing room. The two mysteries that I'm reading is first G.K. Chesterton's Father Brown stories and Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, which I've read in the past. Chesterton is new, and the other cultural I'll mention is my daughter last week on Wednesday, by then had several days off in a row due to snow, ice, and other fun stuff. So she was running out of stuff that she had not read 50 times before and wanted something new. So she asked me if I still had my copies of Naruto, which I started buying years ago because I thought she'd be interested. She didn't read it, so I read it through several tens of volumes. So she started reading with volume one last Wednesday, and today, this morning, or maybe last night, finished volume 46, which is far as I've bought. So one of my friends asked me how many Naruto, you know, is there like a speed limit of you know, Naruto per hour or something?
my folks never did that for me, I'll tell you that. So,
well, yeah, I mean, we encourage reading here. So that's our culture consume. My wife is reading Ream Deep by Stevenson still. That will take her a long time because she generally only reads it a little bit each night. So it's a long book.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
It is.
John, what are you perusing these days?
I have not been reading a lot of new stuff. After I finished the Moore book and started writing about the Moore quote-unquote biography, which I keep calling it that because it's not... It's really someone interpreting Moore's oral history. That's really what the book is.
Wow. That would have been a more interesting subtitle.
It would have been. And yeah. if Parkin had just embraced that as the task that he was performing, that would have been interesting too, because, you know, Moore has written a lot and he's said a lot. He's had tons of interviews, which he's apparently not going to do anymore. But I mean, there's a vast corpus of words out there. And a lot of the book is him quoting Moore. And thus, it really does read much more like an oral history, a guided oral history. And then Parkin tries to fill in some of the context, but it's also very, I don't want to call it scattered, because he's trying to make sense of different things, but I don't agree with the order in which he presents things, or that he sort of shifts back and forth in time, which happens on a number of occasions in the book. Yeah. But it, as an attempt to get into Alan Moore's creative noggin, it's interesting. But I've been reading a lot of Moore stuff. I reread the first two volumes of Top Ten. I reread Miracle Man. I reread, there was a couple of things I have. I read, went back and read Alan Moore's most reviled by him creation, D.R. and Quinch.
I love
the D.R. and Quinch series. You know, they're, I have a love hate. I'm like, this is so terrible, but it's also oddly funny, and the art is really hilarious. So most of what I've been doing is rereading stuff like that, going back through a lot of the Moore stuff, and that's pretty much been it. I've been kind of taking it easy with the reading and doing working on some other stuff.
You got to give your brain a break once in a while.
Yeah, you do.
You gotta.
But I'm about to queue up Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice.
Ah.
And to see what all the hubbub is about. And
that's on my. I think that's third on my list of what I'm trying to get through on the tablet.
And I'm starting to, and I have a list of stuff I need to read on the history of literacy in the United States.
Oh.
For the book on reading.
About the
confluence of the rise in literacy with the rise of the science fiction genre, essentially.
Wow.
Building on from various popular literature in the 19th century and then coming in the 20th century and the rise of not just base literacy, the ability to read, but of people, of education improvements and other social and cultural factors that probably facilitated the rise of a particular science fiction reading population.
Hmm. Wow. You had me at hello with that.
So. A little light reading.
Yeah, a little tiny bit.
This is probably why I needed a break for a
few. Yeah, that would certainly do it. I need a break.
What about you, Jeff?
I got a few things. I spent the weekend pretty much catching up on all my short stuff, and most of my short stuff. I've gotten through most of Beyond the Rift by Peter Watts. I still got I'm sort of taking those stories one or two at a time. I think I've only got two or three stories left. I read Carrion Anthem, the Warhammer 40K story by our friend David Annandale, which, wow, that was a great story. In reading all the short stuff, the one thing that really stood out, a lot of good stuff in the Asimovs and fantasy and science fiction, and Interzone, the last two issues of Interzone I got through, and I was kind of surprised. It was definitely an uptick in quality for them from a lot of the stuff from last year. But the last issue of Black Static had a John Grant story called His Artist Wife, which I really liked. A really good kind of play on not quite gothic horror, but definitely a story that carries its atmosphere with it the entire time, about a guy who thinks that the ghost of his wife is doing drawings on the studio wall where he does his writing now. And it was very good, very, very good. Not a gory story whatsoever, but definitely creepy as hell, as good horror stories should be. I finished, since last we spoke, the audiobook to Jeff Vandermeer's Finch, which I had never read before and which I wanted to read after reading Wonder Book. It is an intriguing story in the Ambergris universe. The one negative for me, and I made a tweet about this, is that when you have a main character lose consciousness that often over the course of a story, he kind of loses my sympathy rather quickly. Finch is knocked out, drugged, bludgeoned, tripped up and ambushed more times than I can actually remember over the course of the story, and in one scene is drugged multiple times in one chapter. And too often I thought that was sort of a, I don't want to say lazy, but a convenient way to get from one chapter to another and from one plot point scene to another. That being said, the individual scenes and the individual plot points that are played out, I thought were quite intriguing. But in the end, I thought this story, it almost sort of felt like this was this story was to get us from point A to point B. It was good. I did like it. It's really well written. And the internal dialogue of the protagonist of Finch is done quite well. But that was just my take on it.
I have that and another one of his. I can't remember which of the series in limited editions, and both came with CDs of music inspired by the books.
There is the audio book that I listened to did have a lot of music in it by Murder by Death. was the band.
Yeah, yep. That's
that,
the
that does the music.
I have a copy of that. That's actually really, really good music.
Yep. Yeah, the music is really good. I was not crazy about the mix because it sort of comes in when a scene starts happening, you know, mm-hmm. when suddenly the pace starts picking up, this music kind of drops in. It doesn't really fade in and out particularly well. Suddenly it's like, hey, where the hell is this music coming from? If you're listening with earbuds, like I was for much of it, I'm going, why the hell am I hearing tribal drums and surf guitar? And so, oh, there it is. It's you know, there's some weird surf calypso thing going on somewhere that I'm not aware of, you know? And I just started today before we recorded this, I just started on today's drive to and from work, the new Christine Catherine Rusch Diving the Wreck Universe book, Skirmishes. I am a huge fan of this series, and I have read and or listened to everything, including some of the stories that led into some of the stuff like Be Calmed and stuff like that, which was in Asimov's.
Read those out of order, or you know,
I would recommend reading them in order.
Okay.
Some of the stuff like Be Calmed, and there was another story about that ship, and their storyline sort of plunges into the diving universe. The main story of Boss and her crew. I like it because it's. It's very far future, and history is a force to be reckoned with. But unlike a lot of other series that sort of play in this universe, it's not about Earth being at stake, or the integrity of the human race is the thing that's you know going to be lost if they fail in their mission. It's a lot of long game conspiracy and stuff like that. And I'm about six chapters into Skirmishes, and I'm going into this never having read any of it either. Most of the other audiobooks, I had read the stories ahead of time. But yeah, it's got me going. I also read the first issue of the new Ms. Marvel comic with the Muslim teenager, which caused all of the buzz. It's a well done book. It's well put together. It is well crafted. I just think it's stuff that we've seen before. Recently we've had both a new Star Brand in the Avengers, and we've had a new iteration of Nova in the Marvel Universe, and they have both been young people, you know, trapped in a set of situations that they didn't ask for, and they have their desires, and they find benefits in the things that they suddenly come across. And this book kind of reminded me a little too much of those two. I'll give it a shot. I'll let it keep going and see how it plays into the Marvel Universe. But the first, I think it was a lot of hubbub about nothing. Not nothing, but it was a lot of undeserved hubbub. Let's put it that way. So I would really like to have seen a truly alien, people talk about the book being a symptom of diversity. I would have liked to have seen more diversity in the book when it came to actual storytelling. It's my take on it. Grumpy curmudgeon that I am. Gentlemen, that was excellent.
Yes.
Yep. That was an excellent talk. I was glad
we may have set a record.
We may have. I was very glad to broach this subject. It was one of those things. I apologize to Fred if I have corrupted him into this particular genre and format of the fantastic.
So far, so good.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it. And I wanted to talk about books that really didn't carry a lot of baggage with them. They could be taken on their own. There was a documentary made about Warren Ellis in 2010 called Captured Ghosts. I have not seen it. I don't even know if it has a domestic release right now. I know it was shown at a lot of conventions. There are some lengthy clips of it that you can find online. And I don't know whether or not he addresses his science fiction work at all, or whether he sticks with just the comics medium in general. But I hope everyone enjoyed this. And until next time, I hope you all have a good evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Yep. Good night.